Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So here we are again, another day in the frying pan. Remember to take it easy in the heat. Remember to check on your elderly friends and relatives. Remember to have water and flashlights and portable radios and lots of batteries. Remember to call 311 if you need a cooling center location near you. And remember to call Con Ed if your power goes out, because apparently they have no way of knowing other than if you call them. And thanks to our creative photography corps out there, who have already posted about 50 shots to our new Flickr page called 100 Degrees of Perspiration. We'll keep this going at least through tomorrow. Photographers listening, get creative. Take your water bottle and your digital camera and go find that unique image of our area in the triple-digit heat. We're starting out at 94 this morning at 10:06, 1 degree warmer, according to the New York One temperature button, than it was at this time yesterday. So go find that unique image of our area in the triple-digit heat while it lasts. Everyone else, have a little fun. Go check out 100 Degrees of Perspiration and see the shots your fellow listeners are posting. You can see everything from one person's attempt to keep their pet rats cool, I kid you not, to the bar on Fifth Avenue in Brooklyn that has posted a new sign, Cooling Center Happy Hour. Gotta love it, right? Cooling Center Happy Hour. And if you enjoy these shots, share them around. Here's a way you can share some of your 100-degree experiences with your buddies or your neighbors or your relatives who are feeling the heat too. Link it around at work if you want, or to anyone else. Maybe to your relatives in Scandinavia or Canada to show them what we're going through. We're all in this oven together in the New York area. So go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show to see or contribute to our new Flickr page. And by the way, thanks to WNYC's Robin Billenkoff for improving the title of this page. You may have heard we launched it yesterday as 100 Degrees of Separation, and Robin improved it to 100 Degrees of Perspiration at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Now, there's plenty of debate within this country over whether the U.S. media is biased one way or another when it comes to Arabs and Israelis. But how does the mainstream U.S. press look next to European, Indian, Arab, African, and other news organizations around the world? We have guests with us now from The Washington Post and The Week magazine, whose jobs it is to review the global media. So let's see what they're finding about this new conflict between Israel and Hezbollah and as it expands out from there. My guests are Jefferson Morley, columnist for The Washington Post, who does cover the global media. Jefferson, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. I'm a columnist for WashingtonPost.com, not for the Washington Post newspaper.
Okay, so you're only on their website, WashingtonPost.com.
Right.
I see you so frequently that I forgot that you're not in the... I don't see the print edition. I read the Washington Post online here in New York.
You can't do links in the paper, so it's online.
Right, because you're kind of blogging and linking to other media around the world. And Susan Caskey, international editor of The Week magazine. Hi, Susan.
Hi, nice to be here.
And let me start with you. You were just telling me off the air that you read a lot of European languages yourself, and tell us a little bit about how you work and how you do this review.
Well, The Week is similar to a news digest, but it's not a digest in that we don't just excerpt from foreign newspapers around the world. What we'll do is we'll take the local language newspapers and read the commentaries. And generally, the commentaries in a local language press are going to be aimed at the local audience, and they're going to assume a lot of information that a U.S. reader is not going to have, a lot of inside political information. So what I'll do is I'll read a column, and then I will inhabit the mind of the columnist, and I will take on his argument and make it clearer and sort of pithier and shorter and in English. So I'll use some excerpts. Some of the choice bits will be translated and excerpted, but what we're doing is, instead of really digesting, it's more like we're channeling these other columnists and really giving you the argument the way they would make it if they spoke sort of cheeky English, the way The Week is written.
Uh-huh. So as you were saying off the air, one day you may be making somebody's argument that Israel should expand the settlements. Another day, you're making somebody's argument that Israel should be wiped into the sea or whatever it is.
Exactly. And in the magazine, we'll present, if we're talking about the issue of settlements, say, then we'll take Arab papers, we'll take Palestinian papers, we'll take Israeli papers, and pick commentaries that represent all points of view there and just kind of put them in a dialogue so that they're talking to each other. It becomes a kind of talking point about the whole issue.
And Jefferson, how do you work to review the global media?
In a very similar fashion, I try to scan what the reaction has been to a given news event, not just in news terms, but in opinion terms, and try and do a comprehensive survey. Sometimes that will be the whole world, you know, with a sampling from Europe, the Middle East. Other times it might just be, let's just look at what's the Lebanese media saying. And so I'm online trying to summarize and synthesize that whole argument, and online give you links to the original sources. So if you want to know more about that argument, you just click on the link and you go read it. But what I do is very similar to what Susan does.
So what your column is called is a daily survey of what the international online media are saying. And one of the things that you wrote this week is that in European media, the civilian toll in Lebanon is often seen as trumping all other considerations. Tell us more about that.
Well, this is a matter of tone that you get from headlines and the leads of stories. And I found that the European papers were much more likely to talk about civilian casualties in that first paragraph of their story, as opposed to a U.S. perspective, which might have that information farther down. So you get a sense of the relative importance of that. Another thing that you saw in the European papers was in the case of civilian casualties, early on in the conflict especially, they were more likely to go and do a human interest story about one given incident.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S. press, that incident might be mentioned in the course of a longer dispatch, and usually was, but the Europeans would go there and they'd do a separate story, human interest story, about the victims of the attack and the families. So again, it's a matter of emphasis.
And I'll read for our listeners a very specific comparison that you gave regarding how foreign online outlets seem more likely to run stories about specific incidents. So for example, let's see, you compared a Washington Post report on the fighting that began, Israeli airstrikes hit targets in Beirut's main Christian enclave on Wednesday as hundreds of U.S. citizens boarded a cruise ship chartered to evacuate them to the Mediterranean island of Cyprus. Compared to this dispatch from the French news agency Agence France-Presse, which began, at least 55 civilians were killed on Wednesday as Israeli jets and gunboats pummeled towns and villages across Lebanon, and tens of thousands of people fled a conflict that both sides defiantly warned would have no limit. So even if you look at just the first few words in the lead, Washington Post led with Israeli airstrikes hit targets in Beirut's main Christian enclave, and the Agence France-Presse reported the same story with at least 55 civilians were killed. And then the Post story went on to talk about the evacuation of U.S. citizens in particular, and the Agence France-Presse story went on to talk about tens of thousands of people fleeing the conflict.
Right. And I think that the difference in emphasis is important. One very clear trend is that the American and Israeli perspective on the war diverges radically from most of the rest of the world. And this is an example. I'm not saying that it's not appropriate for a U.S. newspaper to emphasize the evacuation of U.S. citizens. That's a legitimate news judgment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about across the board, the tendencies are very clear.
Are you finding the same thing, Susan?
I am. I'm finding there's a gap between the foreign press in English and the foreign press in local languages.
Mm, for example.
So you'll get the moderate voices in the English language newspapers from Arab countries. For example, Lebanon has several very good English language newspapers, and there's some pan-Arabic papers that also publish in English. And those tend to give you the moderate opinions about you know, what should be done and how peace should prevail and that kind of thing. And the when you look then to the Arabic language or in Europe, in the European press to the European languages, they're going to be some stronger views. In fact, with the attack on the Israeli airstrike on Qana, which happened just a couple days ago, a Lebanese town, and I think 55 more than that civilians were killed. That was described as a massacre, as a deliberate bloodthirsty act in most of the Arabic language press, whereas, of course, the mainstream English language press would call it a tragedy or an accident. And so there's a gap there. And there's also one thing that I've noticed quite a bit is that you get the anti-Semitism and the sort of racism that comes through in the local language media that does not make it into the English language media, and partly because I'm sure the writers know that this would not be palatable for the American audience to read, but they do write it for their own audience. For instance, after Condoleezza Rice came to Beirut, there was a rash of editorials and commentaries across the Arab world in many, many newspapers that were quite disparaging in personal terms of Secretary of State Rice. And many of them talked about her as having dried up hormones and, you know, she's a barren, unmarried woman who, you know, has no, she can have no compassion because she has never had a child. And
where was that, Susan?
Oh, boy. Let's see. There was one in Kuwait in Al-Qabas. Most of these are in Arabic.
Right.
There was one in Tishreen. The Arabic version, not the English version. There was one in Egypt's Al-Jumhuriyah.
Mm-hmm.
And in Saudi Arabia's Al-Watan, that was a big, long, long article about how Condoleezza Rice really needs to get a husband and have some children, and then maybe she'd be a nicer person and not go around killing Lebanese.
And can you imagine them saying that about a man? Shades of Hugo Chavez. Remember when the Venezuelan leader went on that screed in a speech about Condoleezza Rice, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but I think it was something like, she has a secret crush on me, or, you know, crazy
stuff. Oh,
yes,
and he'd go show her some of what a real man is and that kind of thing.
And
yeah.
Brian, I think what's worth noting about that list of papers that Susan talked about is these are, you know, government-dominated outlets, okay? That Egyptian paper is a mouthpiece for the Mubarak government. Nothing gets in there that is offensive to the Mubarak government, same with the Al-Watan in Saudi Arabia. Just to go back to but I think Susan's distinction between the English language and the Arabic press is very important because there is a big difference. The Arabic journalists who are speaking in English are more familiar with a Western audience, are interested in appealing to a Western audience, and that's not true for journalists in the local language press. But what's interesting about those Lebanese, the English language press in Lebanon is that before July 12th, these news outlets were very pro-U.S. There's three in Lebanon in particular, the Daily Star, An-Nahar, and Ya Libnan. And these were all papers that were very much in favor of the so-called Cedar Revolution last year, the democratization of Lebanon, the expulsion of the Syrians. All three papers are now very anti-Israel and very anti-U.S. in their commentary about the war. The U.S. has lost. It's a very clear demonstration of how the U.S. has lost support in the region over this. These were papers that were, you know, sympathetic to the United States and looking for U.S. help, and they feel very alienated.
We'll continue in a minute with Jefferson Morley, who reviews the world's press for WashingtonPost.com, and Susan Caskey, international editor of The Week magazine, also looking at media around the world as we look at how global media is covering the Middle East crisis. And we'll take your phone calls. Do you read foreign news organizations? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email Brian Lehrishow at WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we compare the U.S. media to the global media and various news outlets from around the world to each other on how they're covering the Middle East crisis with Susan Caskey, international editor of The Week magazine, and Jefferson Morley, WashingtonPost.com columnist. That is, he doesn't appear in the paper. He does appear on their website, WashingtonPost.com. We have a lot of phone calls coming in. 212-433-WNYC is our phone number. And let's start with Josh in Manhattan. Hi, Josh. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my phone call. Mm-hmm. Great show. I'm very happy you're addressing this very timely topic. I dispute actively the assertions that there's a divergence of views regarding the international media coverage and American media coverage, and almost to the point that I can try to say that analogous to price fixing, to anti-restraint trade laws, I do find that there's an awful convergence of story fixing. The way that the international and American media describe Hezbollah as militants and Hamas as militants, or even euphemistically as activists, that's number one. Number two, generally the LA Times, the AP, Newswire, and other, both American CNN and international CNN coverage, there's generally ignoring of environmental damage done by Hezbollah terrorists, ignoring of Israeli personal perspectives in the crisis both in Lebanon and in Israel, the ignoring of the crisis in Israel. And as far as the comments that were made regarding the Daily Star, it's just simply not true. Back in February, before this this crisis that flared up on the Israeli-Lebanese border, there's evidence of Rami Kouri, who's largely acted as more as a polemicist rather than as a journalist.
Lead columnist.
Right. He's an NPR, frequently called in on as an NPR guest. He's made a lot of simplistic remarks that have gone unchallenged.
So let me get some reaction. Jefferson, I think you were talking. You were talking about the Daily Star before and after this all started. Do you want to respond to Josh?
I mean, Rami Kouri has been more on the pro-Arab side of the Daily Star, but in general, the paper, its editorials and its coverage were quite supportive of the Cedar Revolution, looking for a compromise that would enable Hezbollah to stay in the government but also be disarmed. They were welcoming the international presence, and now they're just saying we're under bombardment from Israel and the world has abandoned us, and the U.S. was never serious about democracy. The U.S. was not serious about democracy in Lebanon if it's allowing this to happen. Josh has a different perspective, and I just urge readers to go look at these sites and decide what the tenor of the coverage of these different sites is. I think people can reach their own conclusions.
Josh, you wanted to say another thing?
Yeah, I was going to actually cite, again, the Daily Star, October 23rd, 2002. Shiite scholar Ahmad Saad Goryareb. I'm sorry if I hope
I mean, Josh, yes. The Daily Star runs a wide variety of commentary. You can find, pro-Hezbollah commentary. You can find anti-Hezbollah commentary. I'm talking about the general drift of coverage.
There were targeted assassinations of Daily Star journalists. Many people say there's a tremendous amount of Syrian influence that is covert, that exists in Lebanon with Syrian intelligence agents and Iranian intelligence agents that go largely unreported in the American media.
And where have those reports appeared, Josh?
That is circulated, I believe, in the International Herald Tribune. That's circulated in certain...
Josh, there were some initial claims in the beginning of the conflict after July 12th that there were Iranian agents on the ground with Hezbollah fighters. I've never seen any confirmation of those claims. Now, I guess you'll say, that's proof of bias. But to me, it's a proof that there's not... nobody's found evidence of it. So, and I can assure you, reporters from the Washington Post are not ignoring... stories about the Iranian presence in Lebanon. If there was one, we would be reporting it.
Susan Caskey, go ahead.
I think when you look at the Iranian press, they're very cagey about their support for Hezbollah. It's definitely accepted that Iranian Revolutionary Guards decades ago did train Hezbollah fighters and were in Lebanon. Whether they're still here now has sort of been up in the air. But I will say that in the French press, and to some extent in the German press, there are definitely reports that say that there's Iranian help, that there are Syrian arms flowing, that kind of thing. So I haven't seen it over here in the U.S. press, but I have seen it in some
absolutely.
European accounts.
Iran supports Hezbollah with money and training and arms. The reports that I'm talking about were that there were Iranian military people on the ground in Lebanon during the current conflict. There's no question that Hezbollah was founded with Iranian advice and has long run with it. That's not to say that it's a Iranian instrument. It's an Iranian ally.
Mm-hmm. One other point that Josh raised that is kind of interesting is that it is. I do think it's true that the European press and the rest of the international press present Lebanese civilian casualties and Lebanese human interest stories to the exclusion of, they really do not focus much at all on what's going on in Israel. And you could say that there's a balance in world coverage because the U.S. and the Israeli press present that more, but most people are reading non-U.S. and non-Israeli press, and so what they're getting is definitely more of the war in Lebanon rockets.
That points to the divergence that I'm talking about, that the emphasis in the European press. I mean, there were European correspondents in those northern Israeli towns during the bombardment, and that, you know, that did get some coverage. But again, in the overall emphasis for the European press, it was definitely more on Lebanese civilian casualties, which were much higher.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting about reporting on civilian casualties. Last night, I saw a screening of the new Oliver Stone movie, World Trade Center. And this movie is getting kudos on left and right alike, very much on the right, for simply telling the story of two Port Authority police officers who got trapped under the World Trade Center rubble on 9/11 and were rescued. I thought it was very well done, by the way, but emotionally draining, as you might imagine. But what struck me last night, knowing we were going to have this conversation today, was that it is easy to just look at the toll on innocent civilians if they're yours and you're close to the situation. Because that movie, and it may surprise you for an Oliver Stone film, it had no political context whatsoever. It was just the drama of trying to rescue these two, I call them civilian casualties. They're police officers, so they're not civilians, but, you know, they're innocent people who got caught up in the attack. And the further away, the more we can look at root causes and global politics and long-term goals. And so maybe that has something to do with the way the reporting on Lebanon goes, too.
Absolutely. I mean, Al Jazeera last week had a lead story on their TV broadcast about a 75-year-old Christian woman who was living in the heart of the Shiite neighborhoods of South Beirut that have been hit very, very hard by the Israeli bombing. And she was there with her 75-year-old friend, a Shiite woman, and they were in this apartment and they were taking care of her husband, who was not very able, and they were saying, you know, we're not going anywhere. And there you were walking around in this darkened apartment, you know, you couldn't hear the bombs falling, but you had that sense of that, you know, that a bomb could fall on you at any minute. And this woman's talking cheerfully on the phone with her daughter in Canada. That kind of penetration of, you know, up close is much easier for a foreign news organization to do because they know those neighborhoods. It's much more difficult for Western reporters to even attempt a story like that, much, much less pull it off.
93.9 AM 820. WNYC.org, as we compare U.S. media coverage and media coverage elsewhere around the world of the Middle East crisis with Susan Caskey, international editor of The Week magazine, and Jefferson Morley, who is a columnist for WashingtonPost.com, who also looks at global media and sums it up on that website, WashingtonPost.com. You can also see The Week online at TheWeekMagazine.com. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. And coming up in 10 minutes, we'll be talking about a bill that has actually passed the House. We'll see what the Senate does with it, that is going to try by law to force a lot of teenagers off of MySpace.com and other websites. So we'll talk about that in 10 minutes. Let's take another phone call on global media and the Middle East. And Sophia in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Sophia.
Good morning. Basically, I'm an Australian reporter based here in New York, and I must say I'm very surprised at the coverage of what's been happening. It's the first time I've ever been here in America during a crisis like this, and I just find it extraordinary when I read the New York Times and I watch CNN, and there just isn't an emphasis on the civilian suffering, whereas in my press at home and when I read all my papers that I read from Europe online, that's just the immediate kind of concern that comes out. I mean, the strategic effects of everything, of course, is in there. But at the end of the day, that's the headline. That's what we're hearing about. And I'm just really surprised. Like, I mean, we heard this morning, I heard an Israeli general say how proud they are, or someone from the press office, that their spokespeople were being interviewed 4-1. And I think that reflects basically the emphasis of the U.S. media. And I find it very hard to get an accurate picture of what's going on, what the effect is of the people from living here in this country at the moment. Yes.
So, Sophia, let me ask you, do you think that the job of the news media should be to focus primarily on civilian casualties? Do you think it might be, there might be a point where it's done to the exclusion of a larger picture, and that could actually, focusing on the immediate civilian casualties could actually skew the meaning of what's going on to the reader?
I mean, to me, it's the only meaning. What happens to people on the ground? That's the story. And I go back to someone, Robert Fisk, who's a brilliant journalist in the Middle East, one of the only reporters who actually speaks Arabic and lives in Beirut and has been there for 30 years. He says, at the end of the day, the media should be on the side of the victims. And we can look at this conflict and see the number of people killed in Lebanon and the number of people killed in Israel. And at the end of the day, the more pressing story is the Lebanese civilians and the tragedy that's happening to that country. But if you're living here in America reading all the media, you don't get that. You do not get that story.
I think I agree with the caller that for journalists have to align themselves with the ordinary civilian. I mean, in order to have credibility, we have to take that position. But I also don't think that discussion of civilian casualties and of larger strategic concerns, that's not, we might differ on the emphasis here or there, but they're not mutually exclusive. And you see an increasing line of commentary now in the press on the strategic side, Hezbollah is gaining support because of the civilian casualties. The civilian casualties are not separate from the strategic discussion.
But it's one thing to note that Hezbollah is gaining support because of the civilian casualties. And I think in one of your columns the other day, Jefferson, you noted the turn in the media coverage from just after July 12th when this started in various countries. Maybe you can give us some examples where a lot of the reporting was really very critical of Hezbollah for starting this round of trouble by going across the border and kidnapping the two Israeli soldiers, and for launching rockets into Haifa after Israel responded and things like that. But that gradually, as the civilian death toll has mounted and Israel has continued to intensify their campaign, that this has started to turn the media coverage. So that's one thing to report that. But isn't it another thing to kind of take a position as a journalist that the civilian casualties should be the main thing that you're worried about? Because one could make an argument, this is not to take one side or another, but one could make an argument that there are going to be fewer civilian casualties in the long run if certain root causes of trouble are rooted out, even militarily. So are you kind of guaranteeing a myopic focus by saying we have to look overwhelmingly at civilian casualties?
No, but I think the larger the civilian casualties are, the larger their political reality is, and that's what's happened in Lebanon. Nobody in Lebanon, even the people who intensely dislike Hezbollah and would like to see them disarmed and who feel that the whole attack was very irresponsible, they're not going to come out and say that now, because the reality of the situation for Lebanese is about the civilian casualties. It's not about the strategic considerations.
Susan Keskey from The Week.
Also, if you look at the Israeli Hebrew language press would say in answer to Sophia's concern that civilian casualties are not being aired here, but they are, of course, in the foreign press, in the European press, and in other Islamic countries as well. The Israelis would say that their military spokespeople may get on the air and may get interviewed, but Hezbollah, what they're doing is they take reporters to come in, and those human interest stories that that we're seeing in the foreign press, in the European press, not in the U.S. press, are actually orchestrated by Hezbollah. This is according to this is not my view. This is according to the Israeli papers. So that's what they would say. Is
orchestrated how?
Well, that Hezbollah supporters or sympathizers will actually lead the foreign journalists in and say, look, here's this old woman to talk to. Here is a woman whose child was killed and that kind of thing. And, of course, it's heart-wrenching. And so the Israeli response is to say, well, we can't compete with that. You know, we're not – our military spokesmen are going to look belligerent. And when Hezbollah gives you grieving mother, that looks terrible.
The reason they can't compete with it is the scope of the civilian casualties in Lebanon are so large that Hezbollah doesn't have to spin anybody. The reporters don't have any trouble finding civilian casualty stories in Lebanon, and nobody's telling them, present it this way. The idea that Hezbollah is orchestrating Israel's public relations problems, that seems a little superficial.
No. I don't mean that there would be no public relations problem for Israel. Of course, civilian casualties are going to do their own damage, and we've already seen that. Initially, the Lebanese press, when they were in the very early days of the conflict, the Lebanese press was saying, we're actually not so worried because I think the U.S. is going to rein in Israel. And they would put these in editorials that I thought at the time were a little bit too hopeful. And now they are bitterly disappointed and very, very angry.
Yeah.
And especially then when you have situations like in Khana when children are killed, it certainly turns the entire country. But again, then the Israeli response would be, well, Hezbollah is doing this on purpose. They want civilian casualties. They fired directly from these civilian centers. Exactly. And then the retaliatory fire kills civilians, and it gives more support to Hezbollah. So the Israelis, their point of view would be that they're kind of besieged by that.
And, Brian, I might add on that is there's a trend of commentary now, which is that now that the Israelis are striking deeper into South Lebanon, that this is the Hezbollah strategy, is to back up and let the Israelis come after them, extending themselves deep into Lebanon so that their presence there affects mm-hmm. even more people.
Very briefly, Jeff, is there debate that, or either of you really, is there debate that you see in the Arabic language press or in the Arab region press at all about Hezbollah? Obviously there's rage at Israel, but is there rage in some quarters at Hezbollah for using civilians in this way in particular?
No. Nasrallah, the Hezbollah leader, has become an Arab hero through this by enduring and surviving the Israeli strikes. And
you're seeing this in all the press you're reviewing.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that point is that...
And it has changed since the beginning of the conflict. At the beginning of the conflict, some of the English language Arabic press, like Asharq al-Assad, which is a Saudi-funded paper in London, was quite anti-Hezbollah. And that's changed now.
Yeah, definitely. That's what I was going to say. It's the enduring nature of this, how Hezbollah has managed to last. And it's really being perceived in much of the Arabic language press as a victory for Hezbollah at this point. Even no matter what happens now, they've really already won because they dealt a big blow. They made Israel look really bad. And also they've made the Israelis run and hide. And that's a point that even the Israeli press is making. They're saying, Israelis are hiding in bunkers, and that has not happened in decades.
Well,
so
they've at least won the global PR war for the moment. We'll see where things go from here. If you want to follow the following of the global media by Susan Caskey, International Editor of The Week magazine, you can do so at theweekmagazine.com, or Jefferson Morley's following of the global media at washingtonpost.com. Thank you both for coming on and sharing with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, a House bill that would restrict access to myspace.com for teens.